Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you are in the world, it's great to have you with us. And today I'm joined by two fabulous writers and humans who'll be going head to head in a war of the words a little later on. My first guest won the Edinburgh Comedy Award for Best Newcomer in 2009, which will give away his age a little bit. His first feature film as screenwriter was Wicked Little Letters, starring Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley, no less, and that came out last year. And he's developing other films as we speak. I mean, not literally right now, I don't think. As an actor, you may know him from shows such as Together and Chickens, which he wrote and starred in, and Jamie Dimitriou's Netflix special Harmony. Here to tell us about his debut novel, The Kellerby Code, it's Johnny Sweet. Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
Lovely to see you. I'm doing very well, and even better for having you in the presence of the Book Off studio.
Thank you for having me.
And my second guest is a writer, broadcaster and comedian. He spent many years writing on BBC Two's QI and currently works for Private Eye magazine, where he also hosts their podcast. He also co-hosts the award-winning podcast No Such Thing as a Fish, which has, ladies and gentlemen, had 500 million downloads.
Oh.
I think I've had five down and toured the world. His first novel, The Last Day, was a Sunday Times top 10 bestseller, and his second, The Sanctuary, was a Waterstones Thriller of the Month. And here to tell us about his new novel, A Beginner's Guide to Breaking and Entering, it's Andrew Hunter-Murray. Hello.
Hello.
What an absolute joy to have you here. And I know we've been nattering over a nice still water, but just to do the introductions, Johnny, Andy, Johnny.
Very nice to meet you.
And over the next 30 minutes, we're going to talk about these brilliant books that I mentioned. We're going to talk a little bit about your writing. We're going to find out what you've been reading and enjoying. And of course, we'll do the Book Off, where each of you gets 3 minutes uninterrupted to tell us about a book you love and you think we should all read. But first, Andy, to A Beginner's Guide, could you introduce us to Al and just set up this story and premise for us?
Yeah, so it's a story about Al, who is a young man who lives full-time in other people's lovely, empty second homes without their knowledge or permission. He has a great time. He has a wonderfully worked out method. He's very charming. He's very persuasive. Anytime he's in hot water, he manages to talk his way out of it. He has a wonderful life. And he gets into these beautiful homes. He doesn't break anything. He doesn't steal anything. He just lives the life. And it's all going fantastically for him until chapter 3, when he and his friends break into the wrong house on the wrong day. Somebody ends up dead. And from that point on, the trouble just escalates for poor Al. You know, he's had this wonderful, orderly, controlled life until now, and suddenly he's in the middle of something much bigger. The people who committed the murder are after him. The police are after him. He's in the middle of it, trying to work out what is going on while avoiding being caught by anyone himself.
Poor old Al.
Poor Al.
Oh, what a nightmare.
Absolute nightmare.
I can understand. It's a good idea, I have to say. These second homes.
It happens. It really happens.
Really?
I was talking to an off-duty police officer, and who has quite a posh beat in Kensington and Chelsea, and he said, yeah, we get this.
Wow.
I know. It's real.
Why wouldn't you?
You know, they're just beautiful houses around the place. There are hundreds of thousands of empty homes around the country.
Yeah, so you're saying it's fair. We should be actually...
I'm endorsing and encouraging it. Yeah. It's not the solution to the housing crisis, but it's a solution. It's Al's solution.
It's certainly Al's. Did you speak to this police person having written the book, or was that the inspiration?
It was after I finished the first draft. I was thrilled to find out that it really happened.
Right.
But it wasn't the inspiration. I think the inspiration was it was partly a lockdown thing. It was Christmas time, the first lockdown Christmas. And my wife and I would go walking around our local area a lot. And we lived in Stockwell at the time. And in Clapham, nearby, there are these beautiful houses, which are, you know, the lights were on, the curtains were open. You could see, they were like dolls' houses. And you could just see into so many other people's lives.
Mm.
And, you know, property is a bit of a national obsession. And I think that got me thinking about how you would do it, you know, in a pinch, if you had to, or if you just wanted to be in other people's homes.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't mean this to sound freaky. I hope it doesn't. But you mentioned the lights on, curtains open. And when it's dark outside and they've not shut the curtains, especially in very nice areas of London, for example, you mentioned, I absolutely love looking in to see what art they've got on the walls, specifically to see what they're, or just what's on their walls.
Yeah. It's impossible not to peek and make some little judgments and wonder what's going on.
Oh, that light fitting, really? You know, what, with that sofa?
Horns on the wall, interesting.
Did they kill it themselves?
Oh, gosh, I was once at a friend's home and there was an oryx. Thing on the, like, what skull? Oryx is a sort of quite a rare, now slightly rarer animal.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to ask about it, so I just shut up. So this book is probably me working out some issues about that, you know.
And we should mention, I mean, or talk about the state of housing, I think, in this country, in the world, because as well as being a crime novel, I did get the sense that you were sort of making a bit of a point.
Yeah, I think of it as sugar-coated broccoli. You know, the aim is that you don't notice the vegetables because you're having such a good time. You know, the aim is for a fast, pacey thriller that you just have to read one more chapter of. But obviously, if you're writing about housing, you can't ignore the reality of it. And this, you know, Al's solution is an unorthodox one. He is effectively like a high-end squatter, you know, luxury squatter. But the problem is really real. And it's kind of appalling. If you talk to people, I'm in my mid-30s, you talk to people, like colleagues of mine who are 10 years younger, you cannot believe the stuff they're having to put up with and the conditions that they're expected to just cope with and the amount of their income that is just soaked up by low-quality housing, you know. And it occupies your entire life. It occupies people's health. It just eats up your attention. You know, it's a massive problem. And
I read some mad stats about it, which I won't try to regurgitate, but, you know, it's like millions of people or millions of empty houses in, you know, the UK alone. And it's it's a very...
As part of sort of portfolios of investment for shell companies.
That, you know, just bought up as an investment that sometime in the 10, 20 years...
your niece can stay in for a weekend.
Yeah, sure, but, you know, but they let some of them go, you know, a little bit to rack and ruin in some places. And I remember, again, I'm talking about London specifically, but there is a place called the Bishop's Avenue, which is near Hampstead, and was for a while the most expensive road in the UK. I'm not sure if it still is or not, but these portfolio properties, as you mentioned, Johnny, sort of just got left a bit because they were like, well, we own it, you know, this shell company or this hedge fund own it. We'll sell it off at some point. But because loads of them were doing it and hardly anyone actually lived there, the whole road just sort of went down.
Slumped. It's really down. It was really shabby mansions, basically.
Yeah.
There's a place where Al stays, which is sort of based on Bishop's Avenue.
I wondered that, actually.
One of his bolt holes is there.
Yeah.
And don't they have private security teams as well? So that's not good for Al. Is it Al,
It's not good for Al. His main enemy at the moment is the smart doorbells.
It's
like cameras. Ring doorbell. Like, they're so cheap
so
pervasive. Yeah. And he is... I really like stories about people. You know Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where they're kind of out of their own time. And they can see their time is ending. They're like dinosaurs who can see the meteorite approaching. Al is kind of like that. He knows that his way of life is getting trickier. You know, lots of his usual places have suddenly got better security so cheaply. And so, yeah, I love a main character like that. He's kind of aware that...
Yeah, just needs to catch a break.
Yeah,
just needs one mansion without a doorbell.
Exactly,
someone who hasn't caught up to this whole smart doorbell business. Yeah,
that's great.
Let's talk about the Kellerby Code, Johnny. So could you introduce us to Edward and just sort of set up his story and circumstances?
I think, weirdly, there are some similarities, actually. He's also sort of out of his time.
It's funny that you two are doing this together.
Yeah.
It's like it's almost been planned.
Yes, I know, I was going to say. Yeah, this random meeting is really quite exciting. And he is from an ordinary background, goes to university, falls in love with a kind of stellar, glamorous, aristocratic set, and is fixated in particular on Stanza and her enormous country house, Kellerby House. And then he is desperate to cling on to their friendship, so essentially makes himself as deferential to the point of complete servitude. And some of this is taken from my life, I'm sorry to say. And then so later in life, they've left university, and he's still picking up their dry cleaning. Mm. He's a kind of Jeeves figure. He's constantly booking taxis, sanding and polishing their worktops. And then the anger is slowly building, and he discovers that his best friend has got together with Stanza, who he's in love with. And he also discovers a secret about Robert, this person, which might destroy him. And he decides that's going to be a really good idea, actually. So he decides to destroy him, and that goes terribly badly. And then thus ensues a kind of Jeeves and Worcesterish murder farce, for want of a better term.
Is he the Jeeves figure?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So it was actually born out of, I remember I was, you know, and there is a similar world to yours. I was tutoring in those, playing Kensington, Chelsea area, had lots of lovely tutees, but some of them were just awful people. and I'd often be treated like a sort of extra, like a servant. So I'd often be sort of finish a tutoring session and they'd say, would you mind just hanging this picture as well? I'd sort of be just doing general cleaning. And because I could have easily just said, actually, that's not really my responsibility. But it was like that. And then I was reading.
And you did it.
And I did. I have to say, I mean, that's what, in a weird way, this is what something I think the book is about, is it's not really bashing poshos. It's more sort of saying, why are we so enthralled to these people? Why are we so different? It's really us rather than them. And I was reading Code of the Worcesters, and I remember just having a flash of thinking, does Jeeves ever just want to murder Bertie? So it came from that, but it also is at that age, Edward, where you know, his friends are buying properties because they're rich, they're settling down, and he has this sense of this is just never going to happen for me. And there's a moment actually where he kind of lets himself into his friend's property again, more to kind of sneak than to live, as Al does. But it's clearly a preoccupation at the moment because, you know, that is a very common situation. And when you think about, you know, inherited property is one of the kind of the greatest drivers of inequality, especially when you think about these great country estates and the portfolios that go with them. There's clearly a link. So it's kind of it's sort of drilling into that psychology of kind of deference and hatred that we have towards the establishment, but also it's really just a thriller about about friendship.
A good old thriller friendship.
Good old thriller, yeah. Or the lack of, lack of it.
With both these books, which are so fun to read as well as being like page turnery, and as you said, you know, they're just great thrillers. On the top of it, they feel like they were really fun to write. The characters, certainly the main characters, were probably really fun to write. Is that right? Am I right in that, or was it absolute torture?
I oddly, because normally it is torture, I found it very fun to write this one.
And this is your first novel, so yeah.
I think the first one, I mean, you can tell us. I think the first one is meant to be easier. And a lot of people found the second, you know, you wait your entire life to write your first novel and then you've got to write another one. No, I loved it. I felt sort of simpatico with Edward to a disturbing degree. And in a way, it was about a portion of my life where I was quite sort of people-pleasy and pathetic. And I find that period in your late 20s is quite ripe for that kind of, when you're still forming a kind of personality, in my case. No, it came easily, and I also think I as soon as I got the balls moving, there was just lots of places it could go, and I did have Woodhouse in mind, so it did lend itself to a kind of mixture of a farce and a thriller, which is it's tricky, but it's not too onerous to get your head around.
I sometimes have these weird sort of daydreamy things where I think back to that time of being in my mid to late 20s and situations I was in and think, God, what would I say? Like, if I could go back, what would I say?
Yeah.
It's. I think there is just another link between these books is that we all live to a certain extent in other people's expectations of us and in their heads and what we think they think of us. And that, you know, Al has kind of twisted this around and turned it into an ability and a strength rather than anything else, because he knows what people want to see from him and he knows how he can, you know, manipulate them to a certain extent into thinking that he is something he isn't. But all of us do this, you know, and it's I'm staggered at how much I still do it, how polite I still am on lots of occasions when really I shouldn't be, and it's taken a long time to shake off.
Yeah. Well, know. I think if you feel slightly outsidery or you feel slightly as though you're not completely confident in what you're presenting to the world every day, then you get very good at observing people and working out what they require from you.
Yeah.
So you, in a way, it's easy to become just a kind of summary of other people's needs rather than what you actually would like. So, for example, there's a story in the book, which is true, where I went to a friend's... I had to stay at a friend's house en route to somewhere else. I was doing a gig. And his parents were having a fancy dinner with waiters, and I'd never experienced this before.
Wow.
And I got there and I'd met the dad before, but he saw me and instantly just assumed I was one of the waiters. So he was going, he was basically going, yeah, just get all the place on here, make sure the glasses are in the right place. He was being polite, you know, he wasn't being cruel. But now again, if you...
But when, what happened?
So then I got to work for about 40 minutes until my friend
would
get out.
You're joking.
Well, maybe it was 5-10 minutes. But I was certainly
I'm sure it felt like 40.
But also I would do that, and you'd do that in someone's house anyway. It's just the fact that there were paid people doing it that I felt like.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that he definitely had met me. He'd talked to me about a Parma ham once. So
I'm sure that was a great time for you.
Very exciting. He was off to buy a Parma ham.
Which you later served.
Honestly, I feel like we're twin souls here. This is extraordinary.
Right.
This is my most starry anecdote, right? Is that once at the Hay Festival, Jude Law mistook me for a wine waiter, and I went along with it.
That's astonishing.
Jude Law said, "Where's the wine?" And I was waiting behind the counter because I was friends with some of the people running the festival. So it wasn't a crazy assumption for him to make. It's not like he just points at people and say, "You, where's the Merlot?" And I went and got him the wine, you know. Oh, and then later on, there was a dance floor, and I could see him looking like, "What the fuck is that waiter doing on the dance floor?"
Oh, that's astonishing.
Oh God,
that's astonishing. Bad times. But it wouldn't happen now because you'd just say, "Oh, sorry, I'm not a waiter." But there's some.
Would I?
Well, that's a good question.
I think so. Yeah, I probably would. I'd probably say the wine's over there. But then I might add, sir. You know, you never know.
Mr. Law. I think getting married. My wife sort of kicked a lot of it out of me. Actually, she would sort of say, "Why are you doing that when you don't want to do it and you don't have to do it?" And I'd be like, "Well, I don't know, really." Which sounds insane when you put it like that. But I think all of these, well, I think certain types of personalities are easily molded into that kind of.
And I think very few are not moldable into that. As in, I don't think almost anyone, whenever you read an interview with anyone famous, they're saying, "Well, at school I was such an outsider. I really felt like such a little freak." And you know, I actually don't think they're fibbing. I think everyone feels
exactly
like they don't belong at school and they're an outsider and a little bit of a freak. And you realise eventually there's no inside.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everyone, the old buffers in the Garrick are terrified of people in the streets with the torches and the chalags and all that. There's no inside anywhere.
I agree. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, this Kelleby code is, it takes place in a kind of in an aristocratic world, partly really because of Woodhouse, and obviously as part of that, I'm talking about class, and that's natural, but it's not the main driver of the book. The main driver is that feeling that you're talking about, of which everyone feels, where they enter a room and think, "I don't know how this is going to go," or you meet people and you think they're not going to really, "I'm not their vibe," and it's so pervasive. And in a way, I think a lot of those country house books The houses are just the sort of fantasy of not feeling like that, basically.
Yeah.
I've always found and felt that in some of those situations, and I have been in, you know, a few of them, in circles that I don't usually mix in, I'm viewed as sort of, oh, it's a quite charming, funny one, you know, because of his, oh, look at his, it's quite charming. I'm sort of happy to play it, really, because I'm just being myself, and therefore, and if they hate it I'm never invited back, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But actually, I've often found that it's like, oh, well, he's a bit different, isn't he? Yeah. Fun to have
Sweet.
Him around.
Good to have a jester.
Good to have a jester, yeah. Do we pay him?
Yeah.
Jack Davenport's done your audio book, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yes. Was that a you suggestion?
No.
No.
No, I wouldn't. Because
that feels exactly right, actually.
Yeah, no, I have to thank Belinda who made the audiobook, because he's absolutely brilliant. And I was quite nervous, you know, listening to it for the first time, because, I mean, I didn't think he would be bad, but it's just nerve-wracking listening to it. And he's so good. And I was almost sort of suggesting people listen to the audiobook rather than the book, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. No, he's fantastic.
Oh, I think you are. Sales are sale.
Great. Okay. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Good. So save yourself some bother. Have it run.
Check your contract, because you want to check the biggest royalty. You know.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. What's your percentage on audiobook?
Maybe put my contract in the notes for the podcast, and everyone can just check which one's better for me.
Send it over, and we'll add it to the description.
It's entirely possible that if you funnel it through the right kind of structure, you'll end up with like 110% royalty. If you listen to the audiobook but in Liechtenstein,
just set
your location settings. So I'm in Liechtenstein, and then you know that'll do it.
Is that right?
I mean, this is third novel experience.
You are in the game.
You know what I'm saying?
That's fantastic. I don't understand really any of that at all, but that's really useful. Let's have a quick coffee afterwards. Just get some
few bullet
down.
Points. Yeah, exactly.
Secrets of Publishing with Andrew Hunter Murray. Mm.
And it's, I mean, on that, Andy, you know, it's a question that I ask a lot of authors who are on third, fourth, ninth, 23rd book. Was publishing this one different in any way, either good or bad, from the experience of writing two before it?
Weirdly, yes, because this is the first book I've written that has really any comedy in it. The first two are thrillers as well, but they're a little bit more science fiction-y, and they're much more serious in tone and timbre. The characters are more serious. Al is a funny person. He cannot help it, you know. So even in the direst extremity, he's observing what things around him are just insane and funny. And so writing that felt so much closer to what I want to write next. And that was a really nice experience. And sometimes your publisher will look askance if you say, I want to completely change tone. And my editor, Selena, at Pangle Random House, was brilliant about it. She saw it. She thought, I think I can see where you're going with this. And I think this feels very you. And she's been totally up for it and totally excited about the prospect of a change in tone, which really not every editor is, I think. You know? And the publishing industry naturally wants you to write a book a year in the same kind of tone and style from now, you know, forever.
It's because from a marketing point of view, they sort of have to, in some ways, put you in this kind of genre and box.
And you look at people like Woodhouse and look at people like Agatha Christie. They did not say, right, I'm actually going to do something a bit different this time. So there is a tricky thing there. But you look at a writer like Lisa Jewell, who's on, I think, book 20 or 25.
Yeah,
and she's written so many. And she started off writing romances, and then I think she might have written historical for a spell. Mm-hmm. I think she arrived on thrillers at about book 17.
Wow.
And, you know, she is a mega successful, multi-million selling author who has been through several evolutions in her style. And it's gone brilliantly for her. So it's very nice to see people who have done that and sort of made those leaps.
And similarly, actually, her friend and fellow author Adele Parks has done the same thing, started out sort of more romancy, did a bit of history, is now doing more psychology.
It's so nice because you're so conditioned to think that the debut is everything. The industry is often loaded towards, we'll publish 20 debut authors this year, three of them will do really well, the other 17, maybe they'll do a book or two more.
Right.
But, you know, you need to make this big hit. And actually, lots of authors started out doing something completely different and it took them a while to build. Ian Rankin, you know, has this great story about how he didn't really become successful until 6 or 7 books in. He suddenly noticed his royalties had jumped because people had finally, he'd built an audience. It had taken years. Yeah. And suddenly people were reading his latest book and thinking, oh my God, there's half a dozen more of these. I'm going to buy them.
Yeah, lots of people say the first couple are like a clearing your throat. And you just have to kind of get them out of the way. And I found that really galling. I was like, oh, give me a break.
Yeah.
But also, I can't imagine... I imagine that Woodhouse and Agatha Christie kept writing them because that was really what they loved and found they were best at writing. It's really hard to write a sort of book that you're not completely invested in.
Yeah.
And
they found a voice as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Which I think is important.
And they were mutual admirers. They were great admirers of each other and would always write to each other when they had each published a new book and they'd read it. And yeah.
Oh, that's fab.
Because they're so similar in a way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's so country kind of mechanical.
House. There's some mayhem. The mayhem will eventually be returned to order. Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know this, I mean, you mentioned, Andy, that this one is a funny book, or rather a funny book, as well as being a crime thriller. And yours, Johnny, is obviously funny as well. The humour and crime does match sometimes, and it works well when it works well. But it's also, you know, we've seen it done badly, and we know that the two genres sometimes just can't mix. So did you know that it was going to be a funny book? Had you already thought this, Andy, that was what you were going to do? Or did it, having thought of the story and, you know, started plotting it in lockdown?
I think I knew I wanted
to
do something that I found more fun, you know. And the line I trotted out a couple of times is that I've done the end of the world twice and now I'm doing the London property market, so I'm doing something really, like, genuinely depressing. But I knew I wanted to... I got to the end of the second one, which I really like and I'm proud of, but I thought it's more serious than I am, you know, and it's not... And it a purest expression of what I'm trying to say, or how I would say it, rather, because tone is everything. So, yeah.
It comes from character as well. I mean, if you're trying to write a witty thriller, but there's nothing inherently funny about it, then it would be really it would be really bad. But you know, Al, the fact that that's what he does, that is just funny in a point of fact. So it can't help but be funny. And I think the same is if you've got a funny character, then things will naturally happen that are funny and they don't corrupt the story or feel like you're kind of adding icing on top. It's kind of part of it.
Because I was thinking specifically when I sort of asked you that about Mick Herron, who, when, you know, was first started writing the Slough House series and the books came out and they, a bit like Rankin, I suppose, like, you know, people were sort of saying they were great, but he didn't really find a huge audience to start with. And when they were first described to me, before I'd even read any of them, I was told, they're really, really funny. Yeah. And I remember thinking, God, how can they be sort of dark and really funny? I was like, that's...
And I was
thinking to myself, God, this isn't going to work. Not work for me anyway. And, you know, he gets it right every time and he finds that balance. And now, obviously, there's a TV series of it. There's loads of them. People love it. And so I suppose there are people doing it and it works. The genres, comedy and crime, they do actually match and they've been matching from... decades ago, but it's quite a decision to sort of do that, isn't it? I would say as a writer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is a decision, but at the same time, probably I think what you write ultimately isn't a conscious decision. Often, I think you end up writing what you have to end up writing because otherwise it's fairly painful. I think about my book, and I'm sure you feel the same, is that weirdly it's how I that it sort of represents how I experience the world, which is things are funny and they're deeply dark and unjust and deeply sad at times, but most of us experience those things and we kind of laugh at them as well. And I think if it comes from a place like that and you're sort of trying to express something, even though it's comedy, and you shouldn't really ever talk too earnestly about comedy because people just feel sick. You know, it represents something real, so that makes the difference. And I definitely felt writing this book that at times I was just having fun and at times I was enjoying the craft of telling a good story. But sometimes it felt like a therapy session and felt really cleansed afterwards. So it had that function for me.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. And who knows what the second will bring.
Yes, yeah.
Selling a little or a lot?
Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently, you know, whether that's a new author that you're discovering, a book that's not even out yet that you've had a proof of, or even perhaps someone that you knew you should have read years ago and you've only just got to. So, Andy, what have you been reading and enjoying recently, or who have you been reading?
Well, a couple of quite different things. So I'm a big fan of the Persephone series, the publisher. They publish mostly out-of-print female mid-20th century authors. They're very domestic in their setting. They're often about, they're about sort of women's lives and, you know, often obliquely about women's rights. And so recently I've just been reading Dorothy Whipple's High Wages, which is published in 1930. It's her first novel. It's set in a Lancashire mill town, and it's about this girl's journey to, you know, she starts off in a draper's shop and she ends up, this is a spoiler, sorry, opening her own draper's shop. And
that is a spoiler.
I won't read it now.
And it's fantastic because Dorothy Whipple is so good at writing. This makes it sound like a sort of, what's the phrase I'm looking for? Like a sort of patsy compliment or like a weak compliment.
Right, yes, yeah.
Damning with faint praise. Yes, backhanded. Yeah. She writes clearly. There is not a sentence which is poorly expressed, and you could, but she puts in enough detail that you know exactly what kind of characters you're dealing with and the way they would behave in any circumstances. And she manages to make that super clear while drawing you in totally. It's a real art, you know. It's, we talk about prose like a window pane. It's that, you know.
Wow. Yeah. Dorothy Whipple, High Wages.
Yeah.
Sounds great. And the Persephone series, if we call it that, or the
It is amazing. It's great. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. 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 Really, really amazing. Yeah.
They've got a headquarters in Bath, their shop in Bath, and they all come in these beautiful grey jackets. They all come with their own bookmark in the style of the end papers.
Oh,
they're just
wow.
a class act all the that way is, through, Persephone. I love them.
And what about you, Johnny? What have you been reading and enjoying recently?
Well, I've been, just been, before recording, complaining about The Name of the Rose. But I'm not going to put the boot in. Not that it will affect him in any particular way. I'll tell you, a book I'm sort of working my way through and absolutely loving is called A Certain World by, and it's a commonplace book collated by Auden. And it's absolutely amazing. He's just collected. He calls it a kind of autobiography because it's all the writing that he's collected through his life that he's loved the most. So there's a passage by an excerpt from Byron's diary about when he was climbing the Alps. It's one of the most incredible pieces of writing I've ever read, but would never have quite read because I've just haven't delved into Byron's diaries yet. Ashamed to say. And
that's a bit of a clanger.
Sorry, guys.
Jesus.
Can we edit the Byron stuff out? Because that's humiliating.
That out, you want to look good, don't you?
And yeah. So as I say, I as a fan of Byron's diaries, I particularly love. And you know, there's an account of Easter Sunday by a vicar in sort of 1892. And What's nice about it, and as I say, I'm still reading it, is that you do read it through the lens of Auden. You are always trying to think, oh, this is interesting. I wonder what he stole from this, what he got from that. Mm. So I would buy that. It's a good book to have on your desk or by your, A Certain World.
A Certain World. That's nice.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Brilliant. It sounds like the sort of book which you don't have to read sort of cover to cover. You can have it there and you dip in.
It's a dip-in book.
Yeah, love that.
Yeah.
If you're always lazy. If you just have successfully finished The Name of the Rose, it's great to have something slightly more dip-innable.
Yeah. Very good. That was High Wages by Dorothy Whipple and A Certain World collated by Auden. That's a fabulous selection or recommendations. And it's time for two more now because it's time for the Book Off. This is where each of you gets 3 minutes uninterrupted to tell us about a book you love and you think that everyone should read. Now, I always say this can be absolutely anything. And I definitely don't use the term favourite book because if someone asks me that, I just go, impossible question. So this is a book that you just would love to put in everyone's hands. And if someone said, oh, I sort of read everything, I like everything, what should I read? It would be this one. Now, before we get into it, we've got to do a little bit of admin. Mm-hmm. So we always say the person who travelled the furthest gets to decide if they go first or second. Mm. Now, are you both in London? We're in a studio in London. I think you both live in London.
I do live in London.
I'm unwilling to confirm where I live, but let's assume
let's
I live in London.
Let's say it's in the metropolitan area.
Yeah. Some tricky fans who might be knocking on
it. It's a 20-mile-an-hour zone. Can I say that?
Yeah, that's very good. That's good. Helps me out a little bit. Okay. Okay, let's. How do we do this without... Would you say, Johnny, that you travelled more than 3 miles to get here?
I don't know. But I can check on my phone quickly if you like. Is this good
Johnny,
radio?
Johnny
this
only does it in old English chains.
I was going to say,
which are, yes, you know, okay, previous yeah. administrative.
Look, I'm going to get.
Then how many chains?
Directions home.
How long did it take your oxen to get here?
Your location.
There we go.
And you're not editing any of this out.
No,
this
God
is
no.
absolute gold.
This is what people tune in
okay,
for.
Okay, I've just put it off airplane mode, so it's going to take a bit. So it's exactly 3.5 miles.
Right. 3.5. Do you reckon you've...
Further.
You're further? Further. Yep. Okay. Then you get to decide, Andy, if you go first or second for the book.
I'll put myself into bat first.
He's going in.
Yep.
Okay. He's going in.
Okay.
Now, as I said, you get 3 minutes.
I can sort of find details and take you down on them. Is that how it works? How aggressive am I being in this?
I'd like to change.
As aggressive as
I'd like
you
to put
want.
Johnny into bat first. No, I'll go first.
Okay.
Now, as I said, you get 3 minutes. But yep. If you're still talking at the 3 minute mark, I'm either going to be ringing you out with the bell or honking you out with this here horn.
Goose.
Johnny, what would you like as your weapon?
I'll have bell, please.
You're going to have the bell, okay. That means you've got the horn.
Great.
So I'm putting 3 minutes on the clock. And just before we start it, Andy, tell us the book you're putting forward, please.
It's called The Franchise Affair by Josephine Tay.
All right, over to you.
Josephine Tay wrote 8 mystery novels between the 30s and 50s. She wrote a couple of other novels, but the mysteries are the great ones. You may have heard of her main detective, a character called Alan Grant, who's Scottish. He's a detective who only crops up very, very fleetingly in this book. This is not a... If you hear Alan Grant, don't buy The Franchise Affair. Oh, sorry, I am persuading you to read it. Sorry, right. It's a fantastic book. It's a book, coincidentally, considering the ones we're talking about a house. The house is called The Franchise, and it's the residence of two women, Marion Sharp and her elderly mother. And at the start of the novel, we meet our hero, an accidental hero. I love a story with a character who's dragged into it. The circumstances do not fit them for the situation they find themselves in. Robert Blair is a small-town solicitor who has lived a life of uninterrupted calm and stability until now. He's about 40. He is restless. He realizes that this might be all there is. And he's at the beginning of an existential crisis. And he's about to leave work for the day from his small-town solicitor's office. There's nothing doing. And the phone rings. It's Miss Sharp, who lives at The Franchise, a large, kind of ugly house out of the centre of town, walled off from prying eyes. Marion Sharp needs a lawyer because Scotland Yard are at her house. She has been accused, with her mother, of kidnapping a young woman, a girl of about 15, called Betty Kane, who lives nearby. Marion Sharp and her mother supposedly kidnapped this girl, imprisoned her, beat her, forced her to live in service wanted her to be their maid. And the central question of the story is, who is telling the truth? Miss Sharp and her mother, or this girl, Betty? And Robert Blair, the solicitor, is drawn in unwillingly to trying to help the Sharps basically absolve themselves of this crime or prove that they're innocent. But the girl knows a great deal about the house. She knows things that nobody could have known if they hadn't been intimately acquainted with it, been upstairs, been up to the attic where she was supposedly imprisoned. So this story is, it's fascinating. It's fascinating because so much of it is about another thing that we've been talking about, how we are perceived. The girl, Betty, is sweet. She's calm. She's pretty. She's sort of innocent. The face she presents to the world is one of total propriety. She must be telling the truth. How can she be proved wrong? The two women who live in the house, they're mysterious. They are outsiders. They fit into the model of people who might have committed a crime like this. So it's an extraordinary story. It grips you. It grapples with the sort of the press in the mid-20th century. It deals with so many amazing questions, but most importantly of all, it is just a gripping, thrilling read about guilt and innocence.
There we go. That was...
That sounds so... I have to say.
It sounds good, doesn't it?
I'm into it.
That so was good. A very, very good pitch. We're going to come back and talk about it in just a moment. You can have a little breather now, though, because I'm going straight back to put 3 minutes on the clock for you.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah. Tell you what, that...
Beat that.
I don't want to yield before I've started.
Just before we start your time, tell us the book you're putting forward.
This is Hangover Square by Patrick Hamilton.
Over to you.
Patrick Hamilton is a thriller writer from the 40s and 50s. He is not very well known at the moment, but he's having a little resurgence. He wrote the play Rope, which became the huge Hitchcock film, and Gaslight, which is where we get the term Gaslight from, which also became a huge Oscar-winning film. And I really, I'd like to advocate everything he's written. Craven House, the Gorse trilogy are all particularly amazing. Hangover Square, he started writing on Christmas Day, the morning of Christmas Day, 1939. So I don't know when Josephine started her novel, but I imagine it was a Monday or something like that, fairly average. But 3 months in, 3 months after war's been declared, this is what he sat down to write, and it really has that that sense. It's, I'll tell you what it's about the character George Harvey Bone, who at the start of the novel, on the first page, he is experiencing what he calls his dead moods, which I think now you'd call dissociative identity disorder, something like that. It's where he becomes a sort of automaton. And in these dead moods, and in this first one on the first page, he decides he's got to kill Netta Longdon. Now, Netta is the person he loves, who is an actress, nothing wrong with that. But you do read it and feel like she probably does deserve this killing. She's incredibly cruel to him. She exploits his affections. He's a fairly down-at-heel guy. He hasn't got much money. He's always looking for an opening, something exciting to happen in his life. And all of this takes place, it's a pun on Hanover Square, but it all takes place in drinking establishments, just on the eve of war in London. And it's seedy and grimy, and it feels incredibly real. And, you know, it was written at the same time that George Orwell wrote, The Lion and the Unicorn. So it's all kind of on this precipice of the Second World War, thinking about England's role, thinking about what England is all about. And so you feel this oncoming rush of violence and fascism. And Netta's boyfriend is fascist, and it's about him vacillating between wanting to be accepted by her and wanting to murder her. So I can't recommend it enough. It's also very funny. It's funny in a fairly bleak human way, and it captures more than anything else I've ever read that feeling of what it must have been like just before the Second World War broke out in London, which I don't think of. There aren't many. I mean, there's Graham Greene, obviously, The End of the Affair, which does that to some degree. But there aren't many books I know that do that so well whilst being a propulsive thriller and exciting all the way through. that's good. I was really spinning it out at the end.
We weren't going to say that we could tell, but that's brilliant. You both absolutely nailed it. 2:59, both of you. Like,
lovely.
Fantastic.
Absolute pros. Loved that pitch as well, Johnny. We'll come back and talk about it in just a moment. Let us return, however, Andy, to this fabulous book that you mentioned, The Franchise Affair, which I don't know. And I do know of Josephine Tay, but I don't know of this book. But I loved, hearing about it and everything you said about it, I love that at the end you just sort of said, but above all, it's just a gripping, great read. Like, beyond, I've told you everything, but it's actually just a fucking good read.
She can't write a bad sentence, Josephine Tay. It's stunning. All the prose, you don't notice how good it is because you're in the middle of.
I love this cover, by the way. I should just say, because you brought a prop in, which is great. And I love this design, this penguin cover.
Yeah, they've reissued, I think, a lot of her books recently, Tay's. And there's something about the way she writes which draws you in entirely. It's really well done. It's both at the plot and the character and the sentence level. Like, it's just sort of nails everything. People talk the way real people talk, and they're intelligent as well. You know, you don't have sort of dull characters in here who feel like are wasting your time. You know, her plots are really good. I mean, her most famous book is The Daughter of Time, which is it's about Alan Grant, except he's in hospital in the 40s and he's investigating the murder of the princes in the Tower, supposedly by Richard III, 500 years previous.
Wow.
I know, and she manages to make that a gripping story. Yeah. I'm really suddenly worried about the whereabouts of the Earl of Warwick, despite reading a story that's in a 40s hospital bed.
Right.
I don't know how she does it. And none of her books are the same, really, as each other. You know, like, Alan Grant is a really fantastic lead detective because he's plain, he's plain-spoken, he's Scottish, operating in London, which Tay herself was. He, like her, has kind of two identities. There's, you know, Scottish Grant, and then there's London Grant, you know. And it's all the books are about reading people, in different ways. They're about what you can know of people, and that's what starts off The Daughter of Time, is he sees a portrait of Richard III, and he says, I can't believe that someone with a sensitive, intelligent face like that would murder his two nephews. I can't believe it. I'm one to try and investigate this. And the Franchise Affair is like that, except it's a lot about press attention. You know, a big mass market paper gets hold of this story, and it's like, aha, these two gypsy witches have kidnapped this beautiful, sweet, young, virginal girl. Mm. You know, that must be the story. And people find themselves sliding and fitting into those roles. And it's about whether they can be pulled out of the swamp.
I don't know why I've suddenly been reminded of this story from however many years ago, 7 years ago or something, where, like, just a what people might assume a dodgy looking character who was a neighbour just got accused of this murder or something, and then do you remember this?
Was it Christopher Jeffreys?
Yeah, I think that might have been it. And splashed all over the papers as, like, murderer or kidnapper or whatever it was.
He looked odd.
Because he
was a bit
odd.
He was a bit bald.
It wasn't him.
Completely innocent, yeah.
I don't know why that's just made me think, but there's something of that, right?
This is based on a real story, weirdly. This is based on a story from 200 years before about a servant girl who claimed she went missing for a month. She turned up saying, these women kidnapped me, I can prove it. And initially, one of the women who supposedly had done the kidnapping was sentenced to death before the story was turned over. She was exonerated, and the girl who made the accusations was fined. And I think, what's the word? She was sent to Australia. Transported?
Transported, yes.
She was transported
like that.
I don't really know what the word is.
To America, you know, to the Americas.
Really?
Is where you were, before Australia it was.
In a way, it could have been a great break for her. Could have been.
Actually, she crowdfunded her way to a nice marriage and lived a great life over there. So, in a sense, a happy ending. Yeah.
I love that we've discovered similarities between both of your books, or sort of running themes, etc., as we've been talking about them. And then I've loved that, not knowing what you were both going to pitch in the book off, you've both chosen authors from the 40s, books from the 40s. And in both of the stories, you know, I'm thinking of Rob Burt in your book, in the Josephine Tay book, Robert's looking for something. You know, he's actually now like, I want something, this can't be it. And then, of course, we think of Hangover Square, and that's exactly what George is thinking as well. I just think it's funny that there's these similar themes in the books you pitched. And I loved your pitch for Hangover Square, which I do know. Can I talk about Rope really quickly?
Yeah.
I know that you pitched Hangover Square, but...
No, there is a definite connection. And I think it's quite common to his writing that you're on the side of the... You're in the murderer's head, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Rope's very good at that because he has a kind of... He's interested in sort of devilish, almost cheeky killers or wrongdoers.
Mm.
So Gorse is like that. He's a kind of prankster, and the pranks kind of start to just accelerate and gain weight and become more and more devious. But what were you going to say?
Well, just that quite recently I was talking about the film Rope, specifically the film, actually, which I love. And I was having this discussion with a few people, and one was a huge Hitchcock fan, and they were like, oh, do you love it? I mean, it's not Hitchcock's greatest thing. I was like, well, no, maybe not. But I saw it at the BFI not that long ago, and I just absolutely loved it. And we were talking about it, and the more we were talking about it, this guy who was like, it's not one of his favourites, was coming, I could see him sort of coming around to it, going,
oh,
like,
it's fantastic.
Oh, yeah, actually, it is, because it's sort of funny. I mean, it isn't a classic Hitchcock, I suppose, in the film sense. And I think also that because he writes it in that sort of, it's all set in the apartment and it's that sort of play.
Because it says a play. It's such an adaptive
it's just
play.
It's so
yeah.
brilliant.
Yeah, and what I really love about the Hitchcock adaptation is that he ends it with panning into the windows and you kind of move out and remember society and the fact that civilization has been continuing throughout this. Because I think what he creates a little... pockets and bubbles that are slightly outside civilization, where people can create an odd and sort of parallel version of the world, which is slightly different. And they just change certain rules, for example, don't murder someone. But where a slightly different logic develops.
Mm.
And really in Rope, and it is the same actually in Hangover Square, in the way that Hangover Square ends, murder is a form of art almost.
Yeah,
it's a form of kind of abstraction or creativity. And the ending of, I don't want to say anything about the ending.
Yeah, don't give anything away.
Sure, but the what happens at the end is almost like a kind of art installation in a funny way.
That's interesting you say that.
And I think the Rope is similar. They're talking about it in aesthetic terms, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, it's a while since I've seen that.
No, it's coming back, by the way, if anyone's in London or near London. It's coming back to the BFI, I noticed.
Ooh.
I think in May.
It's great.
And it's also so good on the big screen.
One of the best Hitchcock cameos ever.
Yes.
Because Hitchcock has a cameo in almost every one of his films, and yet you're in one room for the whole thing. How do you do a cameo? And it's the outline of an advert in neon, and it's Hitchcock's profile.
That's fantastic.
So clever. Good. And it's just a glancing little look at when outside of the window.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Imagine what the budget was for that. He must have been so furious with himself.
And just to finish on Hangover Square, I love that it takes place in drinking establishments, but sort of juxtaposed with this slightly sort of, what I can't remember how you described it, but it's, you know, the precipice of the Second World War, that sort of foreboding, I suppose, feeling.
Yeah, and you feel like you can smell the beer mats. That's what I like about Patrick Hamilton, especially his prose, is it is the most evocative writing of that period. And you feel like you know what it was like to drink in those places and to feel that sense of doom.
Well, look, I loved both of these pictures, both of these books. Fantastic. I can't wait to read the Josephine Tay. I must get that. Can't really call it, but I think I'm going to take Hangover Square. Hangover Square.
Fixed. I think that's a travesty of justice. No, I'll take it.
Do you want to rescind your...
I'll never rescind.
I think that feels like the book for me today. Tomorrow it might be different, but I'm definitely going to read this.
I'm going to get this, definitely.
Yeah, thank you, Andy.
I'm going to take this, actually.
Yeah. He's brought it in specially, so you can nick it. Appreciate those recommendations. And here's two more for you. A Beginner's Guide to Breaking and Entering by Andrew Hunter Murray. It's out now. It's published by Hutchinson Heinemann. And The Kellerby Code by Johnny Sweet is also out now, published by Faber. Gents, it's been a pleasure having you here. We could have talked for another hour, no doubt, but... we shall relinquish the studio. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.